Thank you, Lars. It's always a pleasure to be here. Graziella Gelmini has already given a very nice snapshot of the field of neutrino physics. And I'm sure you were all there and you all remember it perfectly. So there's no need for me to do that again. Instead, after discussion with Lars, I'm going to focus on the role played by quantum mechanics in neutrino physics. The point being that, of course, quantum mechanics is very basic to a lot of physics, so I thought it would be fun to go through it for this diverse audience. First, some preliminaries. There are three charged leptons, the electron and its heavier cousins, the mu and tau. And correspondingly, there are three neutrinos, the electron, the muon, and the tau one. The definition of these neutrinos can be given in terms of the decay of the W boson, the charged carrier of the weak force, into leptons. When the W decays leptonically, it will produce either an electron or a muon or a tau and a neutrino. We define the electron neutrino to be the state that is produced when the charged lepton is an electron, the muon neutrino to be the state that is produced when the charged lepton is a muon, and similarly for nu tau. E, mu, and tau are referred to as the different flavors of charged lepton. It's a word I don't like very much because it causes endless confusion, but nevertheless, that's what's used. These three charged particles are mass eigenstates. These three neutral objects are not. All right. We also know that if you reverse this arrow and you look at an incoming neutrino interacting, which it does once in a rare while in a detector, what it typically does is to make a charged lepton, and what we observe is that the charged lepton is always the one with the same flavor as the neutrino. So nu mu makes muons, but not, for example, electrons. As far as we know, this does not happen. That does. And as I already mentioned, these objects are not mass eigenstates. Instead, each of them is a quantum superposition of mass eigenstates, like this, with some coefficients that are the elements of what is referred to as, what I will refer to as, the leptonic mixing matrix. And this situation is referred to as leptonic mixing. I'm going to use a Greek subscript like this to mean a neutrino of definite flavor, one or the other of these, and a Latin subscript like that to mean a neutrino of definite mass. Which has some mass. And although we don't know precisely what these masses are, we know that they're extremely tiny, of the order of a tenth of one electron volt. The next lightest particle, the electron, weighs a million times more. Now, this state of affairs.
Hey, Boris. And that thing you just erased there. what you're defining as the new mu and the new e in your experiments are freshly born new mu's and new e's from a nearby W decay or something like
yes.
that? Yes. Not something far away. Yes.
What BJ is referring to is that
something you're about to say.
Of course.
Yeah, I'm guessing so, but I just wanted to have a reality check on it.
Yes. When I said when I said in that sentence a new mu, I meant one that you knew there was a new mu because it hadn't had a chance to change into anything else yet.
That's right. Yeah. A sufficiently nearby source.
A sufficiently nearby source. One Fermi.
That should be good enough. Yeah.
Indeed. Another way of saying what this says, it says that when the W boson decays into a charged lepton, which I will denote by a script L, a flavor alpha, and by this notation, the charged lepton of the electron flavor is the electron. The charged lepton of the muon flavor is the muon, and so on. It's just a notation which is convenient for some purposes. What that means is that the amplitude for the accompanying neutrino to actually be, in particular, the mass eigenstate nu I is just the coefficient of the nu I piece of this wave function, which is to say u star alpha I. And it may be that in nature, I don't believe it, but it may be that in nature there is a conserved lepton number defined to distinguish leptons, neutral and charged, from anti-leptons. Neutral and charged. If there is such a conserved quantum number, then since the W is not a lepton, if you want this to be a neutrino as opposed to be an antineutrino, then this has to be an antilepton, that is to say something like a positron. And consequently, electric charge conservation tells you that's a W plus. There may or may not be any such quantum number. But if there is, this is the way it is. And if that's the case, it follows from elementary quantum field theory that if I have an incoming neutrino, mass eigenstate, nu I, and it converts itself into a charged lepton of, let's say, flavor beta by emitting or absorbing a W boson, then the amplitude for that is the beta I element of this same mixing matrix without a star. And again, if lepton number exists and is conserved, and that's a lepton, then that has to be a lepton also. All right. Now, although when interacting, one of these states produces only the charged lepton with the same flavor that it has, we have observed experimentally scenarios like the following. Here's a pi meson, goes into a virtual W. The W almost always decays into a muon and an accompanying neutrino. And now suppose you send this neutrino on a long journey during which it does have time to change its character. And suppose it then eventually interacts in a detector. There can be scenarios in which now this neutrino does not make another muon, but let us say an electron. Now, by our definition at birth, this neutrino was a new mu. But according to what I've said, when a neutrino interacts, it can only make a charged lepton of its own flavor. So the neutrino that made an electron has to have been a new E. And what that means is that during this long journey, the new mu has spontaneously changed itself either into a new E or at least into some superposition of the flavors with a non-zero new E piece, which could make that electron. This is the phenomenon referred to as neutrino oscillation. Now, how does it work? Cheating to save time, I already put these things on the board.
Your question? I mean, is U alpha I close to the identity or not?
Experimentally, we know a lot about it, and in particular, we know that it is very far from the identity, which was, a surprise to most people, because the other similar quantity that we know about is the quark mixing matrix, which is close to the identity. In fact, another way of phrasing that it's far from the identity is to say that mixing is large. Hans Bethe has been quoted as saying, and I quote, "Mixing angles are small, but now we know that it's only the small ones that are." With apologies to Hans Bethe, who is not here to defend himself. All right. Here is a theorist's eye view of a neutrino oscillation experiment. We have a source. It produces a charged lepton of some specific flavor, a muon, for example, and a neutrino. This neutrino then goes down some long beam line, hundreds, thousands of kilometers, and then it interacts in a detector via a second W exchange to make a second charged lepton of flavor beta. Since the neutrino that accompanies L alpha is nu alpha, and the only one that can make L beta is nu beta, this is what you would call a nu alpha to nu beta oscillation. However, if nu alpha is actually a superposition of mass eigenstates, then what actually goes down the beam line is one or another of those mass eigenstates. As I said, they are very light. You're not going to be able to know which mass eigenstate went down the beam line in each event. Consequently, the amplitude for nu alpha to oscillate into nu beta is going to be a coherent sum of the contributions of the different mass eigenstates, like this. Now, the contribution of each mass eigenstate nu I consists of several factors. First, there is the amplitude that the mass eigenstate made together with L alpha is in particular nu I. We already said that that is U star alpha I. Then there is the amplitude that when nu I makes a charged lepton, that lepton has flavor beta. We have already said that that is U beta I. And then there has to be some amplitude that describes this neutrino mass eigenstate propagating from its source to its detector. If this mass eigenstate has a definite momentum pi and a corresponding definite energy ei, then the amplitude that describes the propagation is just the usual plane wave factor for an object with that momentum and that energy. All right? And then the amplitude is just the coherent sum of this product of three vectors over I. Now, some neutrino sources are constant in time. Imagine the sun, which is a source, as an example. And typically, the time, I should say, L and T are the space and time coordinates of the interaction point, it being assumed that 0, 0 are the coordinates of the source point. Typically, the time of interaction is not measured. And so, in effect, you're averaging over time. Consequently, if you have two components like that, one of which has an energy E1, and another has an energy E2, the interference between those things will look like this. And if you average it over time, you will, of course, get zero unless the two energies are the same. So if you have a constant source, then the different mass eigenstates that interfere with one another have the same energy as each other. And I will assume that. Although I should say I'm eventually going to get to a discussion of ifs, ands, and buts. Right. So we assume a common energy.
Sorry, I'm just confused because in the why on PI, why isn't PI the same as, I mean, independent of I? It seems like momentum would be conserved at that collision, or maybe just...
There is a treatment of oscillation in which all the mass eigenstates are taken to have the same momentum. There is another treatment, which is the one I'm going to give, in which they have the same energy. In my opinion, both of those treatments are wrong, and I'm going to get to that. Pardon? They're both wrong. However, before I knock them down, I set them up. All right?
So would it be correct to say the sun is emitting coherent superpositions of mass eigenstates?
For reasons that have to do with matter effects within the sun, what the sun is actually emitting to better than 90% is just one mass eigenstate and not the others. But that's a piece of physics that I'm not going into. Please do interrupt with questions. I mean, since Lars very graciously gave me until the time of the party.
For longer.
So I'm assuming they all have the same energy. The momentum, are you okay with me assuming C and H bar to be one? All right. And I'm going to do that. It saves a lot of writing.
If we said no, would you be able to put them all in?
Yes. I have them down here. It only took me all night to get them. Yes, I have them. I can put them in, but I'd rather not. The relation between the momentum and the common energy and the mass of the mass eigenstate is this. And these masses, as I mentioned, they're like a tenth of an electron volt. And the energies are going to be MeV or GeV. So E is huge compared to M. And therefore, this is approximately given by that expression. In that case, I can rewrite the argument of that exponential as E times L minus T minus MI squared L over 2E. Now, this first term is independent of I. And when you take the absolute square of that sum, it's going to disappear. So we need not worry about it. And consequently, we can write for the amplitude for oscillation, the two U factors from these vertices, and then the part of the exponential that matters. From here. And then the probability is just the absolute square of this amplitude. If you square it straightforwardly and then you massage it a little bit, you can write it in the following form. Notice a few things. First of all, the probability for new alpha to convert to new beta oscillates as a function of the distance traveled divided by the energy. That's why the phenomenon is called oscillation. Secondly, if all neutrinos were massless, then these splittings, which I should define, would all vanish. And consequently, this would collapse to delta alpha beta. So oscillation from one flavor to a different one requires neutrino mass. And that's the big deal. That's how neutrino mass was discovered. Before the observation of oscillation, there was no evidence for neutrino mass. Finally, if I were to insert the omitted factors of H bar and C, this argument would read 1.27 delta m squared ij measured in electron volts squared times L measured in kilometers divided by E measured in GeV, billions of electron volts. And so suppose you do an experiment in which L is the diameter of the Earth, which experiments have been done. That's 10 to the 4 kilometers. And suppose E is around the GeV, which is typical. This factor is 10 to the 4. Now, in order to see the wiggle and learn from it, you want the argument of this sine squared to be of order, I don't know, 1 pi over 2, not negligible. But if L over E is 10 to the 4, that means you're sensitive to delta M squared all the way down to 10 to the minus 4 electron volt squared. So what has happened here, these terms are obviously coming from interferences between the different I terms in the amplitude through quantum interference between these coherently added amplitudes. Tiny delta M squareds are amplified into visibly large phases. And that's how we can see that these tiny delta M squareds exist. It's at the heart of this is quantum interference. All right? Yeah.
Concerning the things you were telling before about who's the same in the space between momentum and energy, let me think about that. Say, let's talk about solar neutrinos. When the decay happens, there is some uncertainty because there is some localization in space and momentum. But then they travel for a long time, and there is a decent good time resolution of when you detect the neutrino. So it looks like the things on which you have good control is the speed, which is almost the momentum, if you have while the things on which you have small control is the energy, because the center of mass energy, when W the time, impact is taken by the electron.
There are a lot of considerations here, and I'm glad you asked this question, because it illustrates that despite the fact that it is the year whatever it is, and we thought we understood quantum mechanics, when you really start to dig into this, it becomes interesting / murky. So let me say a few words about that. First of all, this is a plane wave treatment, right? On the other hand, it's obvious after even a moment's reflection that at some level that has to be wrong, because oscillation is something that the neutrino does as a function of how far it travels. Now, you don't know how far it travels unless you know where it started and where it ended. And since you want to see the wiggles, you mean in particular that you want to know the source location to much better than an oscillation length, and the detection point, ditto. But Mr. Heisenberg tells us that if you know the source point with some delta x, then there is necessarily an uncertainty in the momentum, which is bigger than of the order of a half h bar. So if I make that small, this is necessarily not zero. And consequently, this plane wave treatment at some level is certainly wrong. So what are we going to do about that? The correct treatment should take into account that we are dealing with a coherent superposition of amplitudes for a range of momentum. In other words, a wave packet. And without going through the arithmetic of the wave packet treatment, let me just sketch for you the physics that it represents. Suppose I just have two mass eigenstates that I'll call nu1 and nu2. And let's take nu1 to be the lighter of them. At birth, nu1 has some wave packet, and nu2 has some wave packet, which is similar. And suppose that the neutrino beam is going that way. The lighter one is going to be moving faster at a given energy than the heavier one. So eventually, it's going to look like this. There's still some overlap, and the interference between the overlapping parts of the wave function can give rise to oscillation. But if we continue this, eventually it's going to look like that. You can calculate this, the degree of spreading in these wave functions, these wave packets, and you'll find that it's not very large. They're just separating from each other. So eventually you have something that looks like this. They don't overlap anymore. They're not interfering with each other anymore. It's the interferences that lead to the wiggles. So the wiggles will have died out. And instead, the probability that nu alpha will show up as a nu beta is the absolute square of this amplitude, but omitting all of the interference terms, which is to say it's u alpha I, u beta I, absolute square, summed over I. This is not zero, but it doesn't wiggle. How long does it take for this to happen? That depends on how big the wave packets are to begin with and what the speed of separation is. How big the wave packet is to begin with depends on the nature of the source. Suppose I have pions that decay into neutrinos in some decay region, which I will take to be 10 meters long. So I know that this source was confined to this region. That's the size of the wave packet. Now, the speed of separation, the delta of the speed of the neutrino divided by the speed of light is, what is it? It's delta m squared over 2e squared. So we know experimentally two delta m squareds. One of them is 2.4 times 10 to the minus 3 electron volts squared, and the other is 7.5 times 10 to the minus 5 electron volts squared. The bigger one, of course, will lead to the bigger separation, the faster separation. So how long does it take? Well, if the energy is, I took it to be 2 GeV, which is typical of the neutrinos in an accelerator-generated beam, the distance that the neutrinos have to travel before this separation occurs is around 10 to the 19 kilometers, which is bigger than the galaxy. So terrestrial neutrino oscillation experiments are quite safe from this phenomenon. On the other hand, what about the neutrinos from a supernova? Well, first of all, I think the size of the wave packet in the case of a supernova is quite a bit smaller than 10 meters. Because a supernova is a dense environment in which particles are colliding with each other. And each time a particle collides, that screws up its wave function. So I think the size of the wave packet is the mean free distance between collisions. And I don't know what that is, but I'm going to take it to be a Fermi. And if that's too small, fine, you can take it to be 100 Fermis. You're going to see that's not going to make any difference.
Are you worried about the mean free path? Last
The mean free path of a particle that might decay into a neutrino before it collides with something else. So I take the wave packet to have a size of around 1 Fermi. And the energy, the typical energy of neutrinos in a supernova is 10 MeV or so. And the distance to separate now is 3 kilometers. All right, and as I said, if you like, take 100, okay, 300 kilometers. Long before the neutrinos arrive here, the wave packet separation has occurred. So you're not going to see this kind of oscillatory wiggling on the part of neutrinos from a supernova. What's arriving is what Jim Hartle characterized as an incoherent mixture of mass eigenstates.
Can you explain the parameter for the pion decay?
I'm sorry?
The pion decay, you said a coherence limit is 10 meters, a wave packet.
Yeah.
How do you estimate?
In a typical experiment, the pions are produced and they decay in a certain decay pipe. And that decay pipe has a certain length. And you'll know that the neutrinos came from somewhere in that decay pipe, but typically you won't know where.
So why wouldn't I do the same for the supernova and put in a kilometer or 10 kilometers?
Because you know that in the supernova, the things that are decaying into the neutrinos are colliding with each other all the time. The pions in the pion beam are not.
Yeah. And the neutrinos are scattering.
They're certainly not scattering in an accelerator generated neutrino beam.
Understood.
You mean the supernova neutrinos?
Yes. They're scattering to get out. They're made at a location.
To the extent that's a factor, it doesn't suggest a huge wave packet. It suggests a tiny wave packet. Each time a neutrino scatters, you've destroyed the original wave packet into something new.
I have to say I'm also a bit confused because in the supernova our friends are discussing flavor conversions as well, right? I mean neutrino oscillations in supernova. I mean wouldn't that be also destroyed if you only had 3 kilometers?
It says here, but how do such considerations affect the physics of the supernova? What can one say about coherence in a supernova? Very good question. I don't know the answer to that question, but it's a very good question. No, that's absolutely correct.
What's the scattering length in the supernova, roughly?
A kilometer.
Oh, okay.
So for it's neutrino.
For the neutrino scatter, right?
Yeah.
Okay. The neutrinos scatter many times before they escape.
Right. All right. So this formula is correct up to a point. But beyond that point, it's not. And the justification for the plane wave treatment that led to this formula after the fact, after you think about neutrino wave packets, you can imagine the plane wave that I wrote down as representing the center of the wave packet that actually describes the various neutrino mass eigenstates. But eventually, just talking about the center is not enough. This formula does fail eventually. Now, some people are wont to ask, do charged leptons oscillate? So let me say a word about that. First of all, by charged lepton oscillation, we do not mean a muon spontaneously in empty space becoming an electron. In the rest frame of the muon, its energy is m mu c squared. If it were to disappear and be replaced by an electron, its energy would be me c squared, in huge violation of conservation of energy. That's not what we mean by charged lepton oscillation. So what do we mean? Well, here's a neutrino oscillation. We produce a charged lepton mass eigenstate and a neutrino. This neutrino then interacts to produce another charged lepton mass eigenstate. What we would mean by charged lepton oscillation is the production of a neutrino mass eigenstate, like nu I, and a charged lepton, which could be an E, a mu, or a tau. And then in a detector, this produces another neutrino mass eigenstate. It's exactly the same as the neutrino oscillation example, except the role of neutrino and charged lepton have been interchanged. Now, unfortunately, you can't do this experiment, because to do it, you would have to be able to tell which mass eigenstate this is and which mass eigenstate that is. And we don't know how to do that. So you can't do this experiment. You might think, oh, there can't be any charged lepton mass, charged lepton oscillation because the mass splittings are so much bigger here. I could take care of that by making the energy here extremely enormous relative to the masses of the charged leptons. But I still wouldn't be able to do the experiment, because I don't know how to tell that that's a new one and not a new two. So do charged leptons oscillate? Yes. Can you see their oscillation? No.
Boris, you need neutrino mass meters to do this.
I'm sorry?
You need neutrino mass meter to do this.
Yes, you need a neutrino mass meter.
And even then, you have an additional problem, right? Because the lepton is likely to have some electromagnetic interaction before you can set it on the other side.
There are a number of challenges.
Well, if you have your source and your target, a micron apart or something like that, you still need a pretty darn big energy, don't you? To do the job. Have you worked out what that is?
Say, yes, I did.
Oh, wonderful.
Come on, but where did I write it down? Oh, yeah, here it is. I took the distance not to be a micron, but a meter. And the energy that was required was 10 to the 13 GeV. If you want to make it a micron, okay, that's a factor of 10 to the 6 down in energy. But it's still 10 to the 7 GeV.
Okay, let's go less than a micron. The micron's pretty big these days.
Indeed. Yeah, but imagine a detector of that size.
Well, I don't know. Maybe,
nanotechnology
these days.
Nanotechnology, that's right. Okay, I would like to turn now, having tried to emphasize the role played by quantum interference in oscillation, to another phenomenon where quantum interference is crucially important, and that's CP violation. All right, CP violation in neutrino oscillation, or more generally. Mm-hmm. Yes. I will sometimes refer to it as a crossed-out CP. CP is the operation which, acting on a particle F with a certain momentum P and spin S, turns it into its antiparticle, reverses the momentum, does not affect the spin, and there can be a phase which is irrelevant to us. So, because of this, the helicity, which is the projection of the spin on the momentum, reverses. All right. Now, although there is this reversal of helicity, that's a detail that's not very important. CP invariance, were it to hold, has a very big consequence. Cosmologists, of whom I am not one, tell us that just after the Big Bang, there were equal amounts of matter and antimatter in the universe. Yet today, there's only matter, and the antimatter is essentially gone. And this is crucial because if the antimatter were present, it would, of course, be annihilating us. So the puzzle is, how did the antimatter disappear? Sakharov pointed out a long time ago that, among other things, that requires that CP invariance be broken. Because if this invariance, if there's an invariance under this transformation, then even if C is broken by itself, CP invariance is a, would mean that matter and antimatter behave sufficiently identically. That if you start with equal amounts of the two, whatever the matter population does, the antimatter population does also, and you continue to have equal amounts of the two. So CP invariance has to be broken. Now, we have seen a breaking of CP invariance in the laboratory, but only in one place, in the behavior of quarks. So that raises two questions. First of all, is CP non-invariance something that is special to the quarks, or is it a more general phenomenon? Do the leptons violate CP also? Secondly, can we understand why the universe is the way it is? And it turns out that the character of the CP violation among the quarks that's been seen is wrong to explain the universe. It's not that the CP violation is small. In some sense, it is not small. But it's of the wrong character to explain the universe. Basically, it cannot lead to very big CP violating effects in an environment that is hot, which the universe was right after the Big Bang. So are there other CP non-invariances, for example, in the leptonic sector, that can explain the universe? The one CP violation that we have seen comes from phases. So I would like to explain how that works, and that's the excuse for putting this on the agenda. It's quantum interference again. And the way it works is really simple. Suppose you have some process, I don't know what it is, with an amplitude A that has two interfering terms. Each term has some magnitude, which is not going to change when we go to the CP mirror image process, which has an amplitude A bar. For example, imagine that this is the magnitude of some Feynman diagram. That depends on the masses of the particles in that diagram. When you replace them by their antiparticles, the masses don't change. So this thing doesn't change. Suppose that this term also has a CP even phase, e to the I delta 1, By which I just mean a phase from whatever source that doesn't change when you go to the anti-process. And suppose it also has a CP odd phase, that is to say, a phase which does change when you go from the process to the anti-process, so that this would be e to the minus I delta 1. And suppose there are two terms like this. In that case, the rights for process and its CP mirror image, which is the difference between these absolute squares, will be given by that expression. So, CP violation, and this is quite general, requires three ingredients. First, there must be at least two interfering amplitudes. Second, these amplitudes must bear CP even phases, which are different in the different terms. And third, these amplitudes must bear CP odd phases, which are also different in the different terms. When you have those three ingredients, you can violate CP. All right? Now, the way we're going to look for leptonic CP violation is to look for a difference between the probability of the CP mirror image of neutrino oscillation and the probability for neutrino oscillation. What is the CP mirror image of neutrino oscillation? Well, because of the parity-violating character of the weak interactions, when the weak interactions make a neutrino going this away, the spin is always pointing opposite to the direction of the momentum. And in the case of an anti-neutrino, the spin is pointed parallel to the momentum. As you see, that is the CP mirror image of this. The particle is not only replaced by its antiparticle, but the helicity is reversed along the lines of what I erased that was up there. So as far as available neutrinos and antineutrinos are concerned, what we call the antineutrino, and that is to say the positive helicity object, is the CP mirror image. Not the C, but the CP mirror image of the neutrino. So I can...
Is the helicity conserved if the neutrino is massive? I'm missing something.
I'm not converting this into that.
Oh.
These are two separate... I'm saying that when this particle is produced, that's what it looks like. And when that particle in an unrelated reaction is produced, that's what it looks like. Yeah, helicity is conserved. Okay.
You slow down the neutrino, stop it, in principle, because they're mass.
I'll return to that. So this is what you're going to look for. How do you do that? Shoot. Oh, I see. I thought you were talking to me. I'm going to compare the following two experiments. Pi plus decays to mu plus neutrino. And you look for events in a detector in which the neutrino makes an electron. And now you compare this with its CP mirror image, in which everything here is replaced by its antiparticle. And where it's relevant, you reverse the helicities. So this is a pi minus. This is a mu minus. This is a new bar. This guy is going to have its spin pointing that way. This one, its spin pointing this way. That's automatic. It's a result of the character of the interactions that produce these beams. And now you look for the production of a positron rather than an electron. And in principle, you should replace the detector by an anti-detector. Of course, we can't do that. So we use the same detector, but we can correct for that by taking into account the difference between the cross-section for this particle to interact and that particle to interact. Now, we know shockingly little about such cross-section differences, and measuring those things is an important part of the program. But that is a part of the program. So this is what you do, and what do you expect? Here is the amplitude for neutrino oscillation. Now, when you go to anti-neutrino oscillation, let me write it. I can't reach that high. Let me write it here. These factors do not change because they depend only on masses, and masses don't change when you replace a particle by its antiparticle. These factors do change. U gets replaced by its complex conjugate, and the reason, one way to understand that is that where a term in a field theory leads to something here, when you replace particles by antiparticles, it's the Hermitian conjugate term that acts, and so U is replaced by its numbers are replaced by their complex conjugates. So this is U alpha I not star, U beta I yes star, e to the minus I m I squared L over 2e. Now remember, over here we said there were three ingredients to violate CP. You have to have several interfering amplitudes. Check. These amplitudes have to have CP even phases. Check. And they have to differ from one term to another, which they will because the masses differ. And finally, they have to have CP odd phases. Well, if the mixing matrix is not real, then they do. And in general, you expect these to be different from one I to another. So all the three ingredients are there, and CP can get violated. Indeed, here is the formula for the probability for neutrino oscillation. If we now understand that when you go to anti-neutrinos, you have to replace U by U star, then we see that I can add what this would say about the anti-neutrinos by simply putting a minus sign in front of the imaginary part. So what one is going to be looking for is this last line. And as we speak, there is quite a intensive effort afoot to create a global experiment to be hosted in the United States, but with very significant international participation to compare these two reactions.
The same experiments at CPT, if you want the masses to be different?
There are a number of things one can say about CPT. First of all, one can ask what is the probability that a neutrino of a certain flavor oscillates away into some other flavor without caring what that other flavor is, just summing over all the possibilities. Or equivalently, what is the probability that it does not oscillate? If CPT invariance holds, that probability has to be the same for a neutrino as for an antineutrino. So you can check that. And in fact, there was a hint a few years ago that that was violated. That hint went away. Yeah, bad luck, but it was there. That's one thing. Then, as you say, of course, one of the consequences of CPT invariance is that a particle and its antiparticle have the same mass. Well, suppose CPT is broken, and in particular in such a way that neutrino and antineutrino mass eigenstates don't have the same mass. That would be extremely interesting. Another thing that would happen is that this mixing matrix, which I wrote down, would not be the same for antineutrinos as for neutrinos. So, you know, if CPT is broken, all help can potentially break loose. And I used to refer to that as disruptible neutrino physics, but I don't do that anymore because what I didn't realize is, and this I think this is interesting, in the same way that quantum interference can amplify a tiny delta m squared into a visibly large phase, it can also amplify tiny, tiny CPT violations into visibly large effects. So the sensitivity is there. And I think people should keep their eyes open. I don't believe that it's, yeah.
That sort of brings to mind the even wilder thought that if CPT goes, that's such a sacred cow that perhaps Lorentz covariance goes with it. And so supposing that neutrinos are sensitive to the preferred frame in the universe, namely the frame in which the CMB is at rest.
Whatever that means. I know what you mean.
Then there could be an index of refraction, some kind of an effect that would be dependent on that special frame. Is there anything in sight that could test such a nutty idea? I can't think of it off the top.
Well, I'm tempted to respond to this question not directly, but slightly indirectly by mentioning that something that has been speculated upon in this program, and in fact, it's the most audacious thing I think I heard in this program. There's a detector at the South Pole called Ice Cube, which sits in the ice at the South Pole. And Ice Cube has started to see ultra-high energy neutrinos, 10 to the 15 GeV-ish neutrinos. It has so far reported 37 such. We have seen cosmic rays, that is to say, nuclear fragments, protons, up to energies of 10 to the 20 electron volts. And if whatever is producing those very high energy cosmic rays is also producing pions whose decays then produce neutrinos, you would expect neutrinos with energies going up to that point also. There is some, at the moment, I'd have to say, statistically not very significant suggestion that there's nothing in the neutrino spectrum above about 10 to the 15, 1 PeV, 10 to the 15 electron volts. And so it was speculated at this program by Tom Weiler, who did this work with, I think, with John Learned, that maybe there's a cutoff in the neutrino energy. There's a maximum neutrino energy that a neutrino cannot exceed. Tom pointed out to me that the gamma factor, the usual relativistic 1 minus v squared over c squared, 1 over square root of that, for the highest energy neutrinos that have been seen is around 10 to the 16. And as far as I know, no such gamma factor of that magnitude has been seen anywhere else. So we may be on new territory. But needless to say, if there is maximum energy, all hell breaks loose. And you know, it's other particles presumably have maximum energies also.
You mean maximum energy or maximum gamma?
No, maximum energy is the way they phrased it.
Oh, okay, but yeah, well, maximum, if it's a maximum gamma that's important, then the maximum energy for any other particle is going to be really way up there.
Oh, yes, 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 yes. And we know, I'm sorry, let me phrase it this way. A particle-specific maximum energy, a maximum energy that is specific to that particle, and it can be a different maximum energy for a different particle, but they each have a maximum energy.
But that would be in the frame where they're produced? Or the frame where they're...
I feel like you transitioned into questions.
Did you have a round
before
we
end?
The frame
should
be the frame.
No.
Can we give you a round of applause?
No. I will make one wrap-up sentence.
Okay, go. It's the natural special
frame. Back to Boris. Boris has the floor.
Yeah, okay.
Boris has the floor.
In wrapping up, I only want to say one thing. Whether neutrinos break the fundamental principles or not, and it would be exceedingly interesting if they do, but whether they do or not, I hope the discussion of the quantum physics of oscillation and of the role of interference in CP violation have illustrated for you that neutrinos make very interesting use of the rules that we know and love. Thank you. Now they have the floor.
Any more questions?
Sorry.
But it's obvious is that they're in the longest range coherence using those effects.
Yes, that's true.
Much longer than those atomic physics.
Yes, I was going to put it slightly differently, but I was going to say, yeah, and the coherence length is one heck of a lot bigger than one Fermi. That's right.
So to put David's question, to what extent does this test quantum
mechanics? It does.
Just exactly what you're pointing out, coherence.
It certainly tests quantum coherence.
It tests quantum coherence on large scales, but not the kind of places some people speculate it might break down.
So, Jim, what is your, that's your territory. How do you view it?
I wrote down a lot of stuff here.
Right.
I wrote down a lot of stuff. I got no check.
You come back at 3 o'clock, though.
Oh, 3 o'clock, you start
dreaming. All right, thank you, Boris.